Hello and welcome back to the How the Race Was Won podcast. I'm Dan Cash, and we have a monument to talk about. It's very exciting. Woo. Can't wait. What a weekend of racing. What a half an hour of racing. And as ever, I am so excited to get into it with my stalwart co-host, analyst extraordinaire, Cosmo Catalano. How are you, Cosmo?
I am well. How are you, Dane?
I'm doing really great. Great weekend of bike racing. I've got some family in town. They are Escape Collective subscribers, which all family members should be.
It's true.
Who else do you have in town, Dane? Who else do you have in town?
I just learned that Escape Collective editor-in-chief Kaylee Fretz is here in Boulder County, about 10 miles, if that, south of me. It's very exciting
news.
Less.
Yeah. Seven, maybe?
And yeah, you've also, listeners, you've just heard his voice. He's on the podcast. He's come down from his high throne to mingle with us here in the How the Race Was Won podcast this week for a very special reason, that reason being he has takes. And I have takes.
I think his reason is that you're wrong, Dan.
My take pretty sure. Offended editor-in-chief Kaylee Fretz.
Sometimes the proletariat needs to be put back
and
his
he
place. Need,
yes, he has come down to tell us why I'm wrong. Can't wait to get into it.
I'm so excited.
This was a great weekend of racing, and it gave us plenty of storylines for being 30 minutes. I mean, there's so much to talk about.
30 minutes of excitement. Already throwing shade.
Before we get into it, I will remind you again that this is all made possible by our members, our Escape Collective supporters who make this podcast and the other podcasts on this network, including the one that Kaylee Fretz hosts, Placeholders, and also Wheel Talk and Geek Warning and the Performance Process/Process, depending on the part of the world from which you hail. So thanks to our members for that. And if you're not a member, head on over to escapecollective.com/join and sign up, so that we can keep making these podcasts and so that Kaylee Fretz can keep coming on this show with his horrible takes and shouting them into the internets. All right.
Yep.
Milan San Remo, first monument of the season. Cosmo, what's the headline? What's the headline of the weekend?
Jasper Philipsen delivers the bacon. Jasper Philipsen came through and won again.
Did you deliver the bacon? Is that something?
Yeah, that's a saying.
Is it? Okay. All right.
Yeah. What better thing to get delivered than bacon?
That's true.
Let's be honest.
Yeah. Right?
I mean, it's another incredible result in a very huge race where people didn't necessarily have him at the top of their favorites list. Like, he was up there at Roubaix last year and was there this weekend too.
I feel like it was one of the Roubaix result is a result that I looked back on 6 months later and thought, oh yeah. He was runner-up at Roubaix. Yeah. He is a legit classics guy. And I think now he's proved it just a little bit more because he's actually won one. I don't know, Kaylee, do you have a headline coming out of this race?
The guy that you talk about the least in the last 15K is often the one that wins.
Ooh, I
think
like that.
That is whenever you have this sort of, you know, it wasn't a bunch sprint, right? Like Ronan actually dropped a bunch of photos of old Milan-San Remo finishes in our sort of company Slack today, and it was kind of astonishing how big the group used to be.
Oh yeah, right?
And the group is, this was a big group for a modern Milan-San Remo, but it was not a big group by any other measure, right? And yeah, it's, in the sort of modern version of the race, it's often the rider that we don't talk about all that much in the last 10 or so kilometers who kind of pops out of nowhere and ends up winning the thing, right? Like we didn't talk about Mohoric until the descent of the Poggio, for example, right? And I think that Philipsen's just another example of that. He was mentioned maybe once or twice on commentary, and mostly just, oh, look, Van der Poel still has a teammate, that sort of thing, right? versus him being a legitimate sort of, well, chance of winning.
I love that you pointed that out, that the one that wins is the one that we often don't talk about, because it's just really building the fuel for the fire of my argument that's going to destroy you here in a few minutes. But before we get to that, let's talk about the actual race winner.
I don't even really know what your argument is yet. I'm intrigued to find out. But anyway, we'll get to that.
Let's talk about the race winner, Jasper Philipsen, sprinting to victory out of a small group, but it was a sprint no less. And I think there's two big takeaways from that. One, Jasper Philipsen is a classics guy. He can hold on after nearly 300K. This is not a sprint that is like every other sprint. We've seen some interesting winners in this sprint. We've seen groups that have had several great sprinters in them where it wasn't those guys that won, because it's so different after 300K, after you've been chasing back on out to the Poggio. And for Philipsen to be up there and to win this sprint just shows that he is not just a Tour de France bunch sprint kind of guy, in case you needed any other evidence of that. And then the other big takeaway for me is that Mathieu Van Der Poel, MVDP, was the MVP. I mean, for Philipsen, he was all in for his teammate. And I think knowing that they had this potential 1-2 punch and also kind of keeping Philipsen from being too heavily in the discussion beforehand helped. Alpecin de Koenig was able to let MVDP chase down Tadej Pogacar, who was the number one threat to a sprint. And in the end, Van Der Poel chased him down twice. He also helped chase down an attempted move at the very end by Matteo Sobrero and Tom Pidcock, and was just all in. He was all in for Jasper Philipsen.
And Mohoric.
He did a lot of chasing.
He pulled the Mohoric move back too.
Yeah. And that, to me, it's something that you can do, obviously, if you're Mathieu Van Der Poel and you have the legs, and also if you are committed. Because if you're wishy-washy on, should I chase this down? I don't know. What about my own chances? And we have seen plenty of riders do that over the years. You might lose and your teammate might lose. But in this instance, Van Der Poel was all in. He was all in and gave up his own chances. And I think he deserves a lot of credit for that, for being there to help Philipsen. And at the end of the day, Philipsen finished it off, because there were other teams. Trek was one of them. They were all in for a rider. I think they were all in for Peterson on the day. And his sprint wasn't there. And we've seen Peterson sprint super fast, but just wasn't there at San Remo, on the day. And I think a Visma Lisa bike, I think they were pretty heavily invested in Christophe Laporte on the day. At some point in the day, they may have realized that wasn't the best investment.
This past weekend.
Can I just say that when I am made Grand Chancellor of Professional Cycling, I will not allow Wout van Aert to go to altitude instead of come to Milan-San Remo.
I'd vote for that.
Yeah, it's one of those things where we don't want to talk about the cycling calendar. We spent enough time, particularly on placeholders, talking about the cycling calendar. But, one of the things that makes a sport great is watching the best teams or the best athletes compete against each other over and over and over again. It changed the entire makeup of the race, and it's a damn shame. And frankly, again, if I was made Grand Chancellor, it wouldn't be allowed. He wouldn't be allowed to go to altitude to go prepare. Because, his whole thing is he wants to go do Flanders and Roubaix. He wants to win those. He's willing to sacrifice Milan-San Remo, basically.
A race that he has won. It's the only one he's won.
And I don't care. He should be forced to race it.
I kind of agree. Yeah.
This is what they're trying to do in cyclocross. The thing is, in cyclocross, there are, like, I believe 97 rounds of the World Cup, which is really too many for anyone to do. But there are only 5 monuments and, half a dozen top-tier spring classics where mandating appearances actually kind of feels like it might be the right move.
I do feel partially responsible for this. Not me, Dane, Cash, the individual podcaster, but like as the media, I have certainly, as a media member, contributed to the Visma Lisa Bikes 2023 campaign was kind of a disappointment vibes that I think the team itself has. Classics campaign, specifically.
I was just making a face at you.
Yeah, let me clarify. Their Classics campaign, where they didn't win any of the big ones despite seemingly winning everything else. I think that is the big reason why Van Aert has decided to say, I'm not even going to race San Remo this year. And sorry for making you feel bad, Visma. Please come race San Remo, Wout. We need you at this race. It makes it better.
When Wout comes back to San Remo, we can start saying Visma Lisa Bike.
Oh,
until then,
that yeah, you're Visma. Holding that sponsorship.
They want it to happen.
Here's the reality. Visma Lisa Bike treating Milan-San Remo like Euskaltel Euskadi used to treat Paris-Roubaix is shameful. It is shameful, and they should be embarrassed for themselves. And they should bring Wout van Aert to Milan-San Remo next year.
Yeah, I think there are not many people that can catch Tadej Pogacar and Mathieu Van Der Poel going over the top of the Poggio. But I would like to see Van Aert up there trying every year. MVP Van Der Poel, but it was Philipsen who won the race.
Is there anybody here who could possibly tell me how the race was victoried? Or wait, we could use it now. How the race was won? Yeah. Cosmo, no, how was the race won?
Okay. Yeah, it's Milan San Remo. It's super long. There was a tailwind. It was really fast. As usual, nothing really happened until the Cipressa. Let's start at the Capo Berta.
What about the first 6 hours is what I think you would have said. So I'm glad you've come over to my side that this race only really starts at the end.
I'm just for summary purposes. Yeah, UAE looked like they were going to try stuff over Capo Berta. They had a bunch of people on the front. They looked like they were going to do it into Cipressa, except Ineos kind of pulled this rabbit out of their hat and got to the front, and also EF. And also shout out to Luke Lamperti, who's been doing everything for Soudal Quickstep this spring, getting Alaphilippe forward to be there. Basically, there's a wall of guys that UAE spent a kilometer trying to ride around. Finally got Del Toro on the front, who I honestly thought was going to split the field permanently over the Cipressa. At one point, it was a single file line with 20 riders, a gap, and then 15 riders. And then you could watch Del Toro's soul leave his body as he hit the steep part of the climb and absolutely died. And everybody clumped up. Yeah, there's Wellens and Pogacar had a chat after this, trying to decide what to do. Pogacar got on the radio. Finally, Wellens decided to go fast again. But by that point, you know, they're less than a K from the top. It's not that steep. Everybody, you know, the top guys can grit their teeth and make that happen. And so there wasn't any more action till the bottom of the Cipressa when Davide Bice went for the last sole surviving breakaway of the day move. And Pidcock proceeded to take a leak front and center, which, you know, awesome, good work. And then it was kind of a regrouping, like that was a good spot to take a leak. And then
Red Bull activation. He's saying
Red Bull activation. Red Bull sponsor activation.
That's right.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Lidl Trek took over, leading into the Poggio. Ghana wasn't in super good position. I don't know if he missed the train because Kwiatkowski did bring Pidcock up, but Ghana had to do a lot of work pretty early. Halfway up, Pedersen kind of lost his place, had to do a little bit of work. 6.5K to go. Wellens finally pulls off. Pogacar launches. Wellens gets in the way, kind of forces Ghana and Matthews to adjust their lines a little bit to get around him. Opens up a few gaps, notably not to Philipsen. He really just never really left a wheel, was always following wheel until the very, very top of the climb. Mm. Basically, Vanderpool pulled everybody back up to Pogacar. Pogacar looked back, was like, I don't want to tell you guys. And the first nine or so riders clumped up. And then Jasper Stuyven from Trek made a surge to try and just keep a bigger regroup from happening. Pogacar countered that. And that was, you know, looked like he might get away because Matthew Vanderpool was four or five wheels down, had to ride past all those people, keep the effort going, finally made the connection right at the top. I think just before the corner at the top of the Poggio, maybe Philipsen got into the wind a little bit to move up, but that was it. There were never gaps in front of him. He never got out of anybody's wheel. Just very smart riding. Coming down the descent, clearly Vanderpool, I mean, we know that he's a real Ricky Bobby. That is, you know, he either crashes or he wins. It definitely didn't look like that on Saturday. He was kind of holding back.
Who's the John C. Riley in that movie? Who was he on Saturday? He's the John C. Riley character, right?
The name of
but whatever
John
that
C.
guy
Riley
is, that's who he was, I think.
Yeah. No, he was definitely he was shake and not bake.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. That. Yeah.
But yeah, he's you know, eventually Pidcock started riding through him, got up to the front. Vanderpool seemed like for a moment he was gonna try and come around Pidcock and then actually sat up and looked back. And that was just a huge signal that like he was there on already working for Philipsa. Mohorič had another aggressive descent, and as soon as Vanderpool looked back, he hit it. I mean, the perfect time, the right attack, just didn't work out for him because Vanderpool chased him down. We saw Sobrero from Bora shoot his shot, and then Pidcock kind of countered off of that. And so Vanderpool did most of the chase up to Pidcock. Jasper Stuyven did a big launch, kind of set Pedersen off on the racer's right side of the road and then went over and obstructed the racer's left just a little bit, not illegally. But you could see kind of Pogacar had to adjust a little bit as Michael Matthews and Philipsa came by. And there was just about a rider's width between Matthews' handlebars and the barriers. And Philipsen decided he could get in there. At some point, Matthews' glasses fell off. It was pretty close in the final meters, but Philipson, I think, by about half a wheel, a third of a wheel with the win, followed by Matthews, followed by Pogacar, which is a nice kind of San Remo style finish where you have a decidedly not sprinter in Pogacar, legit kind of beating a guy like Pedersen, who, as you mentioned earlier, Dane, just did not, the sprint was not there. I don't know if he did too much work or just wasn't on it, but yeah, that's how it was won.
I think the sprint at the end of that race, always that happens. I mean, literally, that you, like you said, it's a good San Remo finish. And we saw multiple riders for whom that was the case. Now, Pedersen has beaten, you know, Tour de France bunch sprinters. And Pogacar was pretty comfortably ahead of them. It wasn't really all that close. It was close enough for Philipsen, I think. I mean, I don't know this, but based on his reaction, it seemed like he didn't know at first whether he'd won. Either that or he was so in disbelief that he had won. I'm not sure which it was. There seemed to be some disbelief or uncertainty, but it was pretty close.
I say Matthews definitely seemed like he knew right away, because yeah, there's a, I think SBS maybe, somebody had a camera, like iPhone camera, a couple hundred meters past the line, and Philipsen rose through and he's just kind of on the bars, and Matthews, it's like this, just like head and hands almost.
Yep. He was,
so I think he definitely felt like he had a pretty good shot at winning that. And it just didn't work out for him.
Well, I think he did. I mean, I think that, as I said, I think that Vanderpool is sort of MVP for Philipsen. I think Philipsen did a great sprint, proved all of us that he is a classics rider who can sprint, in case we didn't know that. I do also think, though, that Michael Matthews, I think, could have closed that gap. And I think that's a question that a lot of people have after this race, is could Matthews have won if he had just ridden a little bit to his left, I think it would have been. And I think he probably could have done that without relegating himself. Kaylee?
Oh, easily. Yeah. And the reason why he could have done it without relegating himself is because he had to avoid, I think it was, must have been Stuyven coming off the front. So he had a reason to move left, basically. So he could go to the UCI jury and say, listen, I had to go around this other rider. That's why I hit the left-hand side. That's why I stayed in the left-hand side. He basically opened the door back up for Philipsen after that. I think it was a very classy thing to do. He roughly kept his line in the last sort of 50 meters or so. I think it's commendable. I'm not sure he was actually fully aware of what was happening to his left. I'm not sure that, like, you can say he saw Philipsen coming and left the door open. Yeah. I kind of doubt that, actually. But we can call it a classy move regardless. I think that he will probably regret for a very long time not closing that door. And I think that 20 years from now, if we were looking back at Michael Matthews, I think he would much rather be known as the rider who won Milan-San Remo than the rider who left the door open. And that was classy, right? Like, no one really cares how classy you were 15 years from now, 20 years from now. They do care how many monuments you won. And so I think he will kind of actually regret that decision, which, I don't know, is a little bit unfortunate, but it's just the way that cycling is these days. And he could have won it. Yeah. I think he could have won it, is basically what I'm saying.
I mean, he had position too. There was a section of the sprint where he was fully in front of Philipsen. It would not have been him, you know, cutting Philipsen off in any way. There was a section where he literally was fully in front of him and could have just kind of slightly veered to the left a little to close the door. And he would not have been, there would not have been him adding any risk of a crash, but he didn't do it. And he may rue the day. That was his third San Remo podium without a win. He's also done that three times at Worlds, which is rough. I mean,
it's rough.
You guys have a lot of faith in UCI juries to make decisions based on rules and not just what things look like and what kind of story is going to come out of it. Because, I mean, it all depends, right? Like, there's closing the door a little, there's closing the door a lot. Like, does he contact Phillips in any way when he's doing this? Like, it's such a crapshoot. Like, I agree. I think, you know, if I'm playing Pro Cycling Manager 7 or whatever the number is now, like, yeah, I'm definitely going to close the door. But actually, having actually raced a bike after 45 minutes versus 6 hours, like, I don't know that I could reliably close that space down and do it in a way that was just the right way that would allow, you know, the sort of kind of obstruction that would slow Philipsen down enough that I could win the race. Like, I have a hard time being like, oh, if Matthews had just cut him off. And it's like, well, I don't know if I want to put this one in the hands of the UCI jury.
Yeah, but I think the UCI jury would like Matthews more than they like Philipsen.
Yeah, that's,
I
I think that might be true, but I also think that because Matthews had position, that's why I think it was less of a risk. I also think, though, that even leaving that gap, there's a Discord commenter during the race who suggested this, and I certainly think it's worth considering. His glasses fell off, and I'm wondering if the nanosecond of, like, WTF, what's going on? Oh, my glasses fell off.
Well, didn't he say that? Like, did he say he had to stop pedaling for a second?
Yeah, does that make a difference in the race?
He pedaled the entire time.
He did not stop pedaling, but you know, it's a good.
It definitely doesn't make it any easier.
Yeah, I'm wondering.
As hard as you can after 6 hours.
This is an equipment failure. You know, this is something that I think another thing he'll rue. Maybe wear your sunglasses differently moving forward. I don't know. It could have made a difference.
I'm just super bummed for him. I'm just like genuinely bummed for him, right? Like, Philipson, frankly, is the type of rider he has the skill set, and crucially, as Cosmo was alluding to in his How the Race Was Won segment, has the teammate to make this happen again, right? Like, I think he will have more opportunities. Matthews is near the end of his career. He's not at the end of his career, but he's near the end of his career. He was in the perfect position. He was literally like, move a foot to the left. Sorry, should we do this in metric? Move, how many? 24 centimeters? I don't know how many centimeters it is.
Sure. So
move a bit to the left. And you win Milan-San Remo, right? Like, I think he will be thinking of that for a very long time. And it bums me out because I like Michael Matthews and I would love to see him win Milan-San Remo. Like, that's a better story for me as somebody who is, you know, a quote unquote neutral, right? Like, I'm not a fan per se of any of the riders that are in that front group. Certainly not a fan of Philipson or a fan of Matthews. As a neutral, that's a better finish for me. That's a better winner. So I was bummed out by it. I think he'll rue the day for quite some time.
Let's take a quick break before we dissect the UAE Team Emirates day.
And how wrong Dane is.
And how wrong Kelly is.
Dane.
Break. Okay, so the sort of real reason that Kelly's on this podcast is that I had an opinion about this race that I actually had going into San Remo before the weekend started. I put it out there into the world. And I felt very validated by what happened at San Remo this year and also last year and also literally every year, basically, that I've ever watched it.
You felt validated because the race that you thought was bad was actually good.
No, not that. Not
was
that.
The end of this race not good?
No. That wasn't the opinion I'm talking about. No. Different opinion.
Wait, Dane doesn't... We can get into that opinion separately.
We've gotten into that on placeholders. I think Milan-San Remo is an awesome half an hour of racing. This opinion in question, though, is that I do not think San Remo is hard enough for Tadej Pogacar to win. And I think that the route... puts this race out of reach for Pogacar, and I think that nothing that UAE could have done is going to change that. And that is essentially what I thought going in. I didn't think Pogacar was ever going to be able to solo away, and coming out of the race, the fastest Milano-San Remo ever.
What? Whoa.
Still agree with myself. Okay. Yeah? Kaylee?
Okay.
Why am I wrong? Tell me why I'm wrong. Justify your presence on this podcast in addition to being the boss. You know,
myriad ways.
Yeah.
Myriad ways in which you are wrong, Dane. I will. We're gonna touch on a couple, actually. So first and foremost, you have a couple of sort of major points here. I want to make sure I'm understanding you properly.
Yeah, let's do
so. So first and foremost, you are saying that Pogacar cannot win Milan-San Remo.
Right now, yes.
Do you stand by that chaotic, insane proposition?
Yeah, unless Vanderpool and Van Aert both decide to do what we really don't want them to do, skip this race. I don't think Pogacar's winning this race anytime. I think Pogacar might win the race in 15 years when everybody forgets that he's Tadej Pogacar. Maybe.
Pogacar beat Vanderpool. You're aware of that, right?
Like, yeah, I'm aware of that. Yeah, he finished third.
No.
Yeah.
We're gonna get to all these.
To what you're saying, though, Kaylee.
I'm first breaking apart your...
No,
your,
yeah.
I'm just breaking your argument into its atomic units so that I may explode them.
Right, piece by piece. Well, we have a Discord comment who actually phrased this really well. So Struan, one of our members on Discord, asked the question that I think gets at the heart of this debate. And the question is, Is the UAE approach to Milan-San Remo inherently flawed, which I think it is, or
no.
Is it an execution issue, which I think you think it was? Yeah, it I think that I yeah. think that gets to the heart of it. I don't think UAE can solo Pogacar away. You disagree?
So there's two different things here. First and foremost, you saying Pogacar cannot win Milan-San Remo is crazy
right now
and wrong. No, not like ever. He could win it next year because
if Van Der Poel and Van Aert aren't there, yeah, sure.
No. Van Der Poel was there and he beat Van Der Poel and he can out sprint riders who nominally are better sprinters than him, i.e. Mats Pedersen, for example, this year. Also Van Der Poel, he did a bunch of work. He's kind of a separate question. So I think that Pogacar can win this race in a sprint.
Tell me more.
Against
That's big.
A group of similar size to the one that came to the line this year, and certainly, and this is very important, a group slightly smaller. So I'm thinking, for example, of the, what was it, Alaphilippe, Kwiatkowski, Sagan, was that
yeah.
the trio?
Yep.
That famous photo where they're like touching each other across the finish line. A group like that, for example, if Pogacar can find his way into a group like that, I think he can win this bicycle race. So there is the first side of your argument, thoroughly debunked.
Okay.
We'll move on to the second side, which is kind of the bigger thing, which is that is UAE's tactic wrong here? Is it, should they be, bringing a sprinter? Should they be trying to do something else other than launching Pogacar solo on the Cipressa or the Poggio,
which was their tactic, really. Clearly on
which
Saturday.
Was their tactic.
Yeah.
So if we go back to this weekend, I think first and foremost, it was an execution problem. I think it was an execution problem because where the hell was Mark Hirschi and Ulisse? You talked earlier about how Del Toro almost split that group. Actually, I guess it was Cosmo. Almost split that group on the Cipressa, all by himself. And then they get to sort of a couple K to go on the Cipressa, 1.5, whatever it was. And Del Toro's done, very clearly done. Pogacar and Wellens kind of look at each other like, well, crap. It's just
they
the two
like
of us.
Full conversation.
They did. They had
yeah, it's it like it's like not look, supposed it's like, to.
What do we do now?
there's a photo of like the end of Del Toro's. It's really the moment where Del Toro's soul is removed from his body, and it's like Del Toro, Wellens, Pogacar, and then like every major bike racer on the planet lined up behind them.
Except
right? everybody from Alaphilippe to Stefan Kung to Van Der Poel to Philipsen to like everybody is like, and you're just like, how is Del Toro supposed to split that by himself? It's basically impossible. However, if that team was operating properly and there were two more riders, for example, that were riding at the strength that Del Toro is riding, that group does go over the Cipressa a lot smaller than it would otherwise. So I'm not saying it is easy. I'm not saying it's totally feasible, but I'm saying it is possible that, like, for example, if you had a Visma strength team with Pogacar at the front of it,
that's not what he has.
The race is,
he doesn't have that.
Yeah. Yeah, but like UAE could at some point, right? Like they have the money to buy these riders. We're talking in theories here, right? So if UAE is stronger, or Hirschi does his job, or Ulisse does his job in a way that makes more sense, as opposed to just like making it slightly fast up the Tre Capi, which made no sense whatsoever. If they apply all of those riders to the Cipressa and then the Poggio, and they have riders that are either on better form than they currently are right now, or just better riders, I think it is absolutely possible that Pogacar hits, you know, quarter of the way up the Poggio, halfway up the Poggio, and that group is half the size as it was over the weekend, right? And in that eventuality, I think it is absolutely possible that the two moves that he made bring that group down instead of from, what was it, Cosmo? You said 9 riders, I think, was sort of the split at one point.
Yeah, the split, the thing where nobody came back from, was it 6.5K when Pogacar first attacked? That broke the field and no one came back from that separation. And then a group of 9 were kind of in touch as people were catching back up to Pogacar and looked around at each other.
Kind of ones and twos, and then they got back together.
Exactly. So the ones and twos stays ones and twos, right? If that Chipressa is harder. And part of the reason why I say this is because I think people underestimate the sort of the back-to-back efforts and what that does to your legs at 300 kilometers, right? Because we sort of acknowledge that a sprint at the end of 300K or 288 or whatever the last weekend was is very, very different from a sprint at 185K or 200K or even 250K. The same thing happens with these efforts. The Chipressa is not short. Chipressa is a 9-minute full gas effort. The Poggio is what, is it 6 or 5? Full gas effort, right? Anybody who's ever done, for example, like an individual pursuit on the track knows that that length of effort is actually one of the most painful, terrible things you can possibly do, right? And so I'm saying that if the setup is correct, if UAE actually does make the Chipressa hard, which they didn't, then Pogacar can use the Poggio to go, if not solo, then a much smaller group than he was riding with. Now, I'm going to immediately bat back your response, which is, it was the fastest race ever, right?
Yes, it was.
I don't care. You know why it was the fastest race ever? Because
tell me, yeah.
It was the fastest race ever because they came... I've been talking for like 10 minutes now. It was the fastest race ever because they came into the Trecapi and then the Chipressa with a higher average speed than they have previously. So the fast part...
described is very tautological. They had the highest average speed, so it was also the fastest race. Yes, that is true. But continue.
I'm saying that it was faster before they got to those two climbs.
And
right?
then...
And
fastest Poggio ever.
Right, but I'm also saying that like... You have to wait for the end of my argument here. So the beginning of the race is faster, and Pogacar said, this is from his interview, that the beginning of the race was dead easy. Right?
Yeah.
It was super, super easy. They're just hanging out. The Poggio, obviously, never going to be easy. The Chipressa, never going to be easy. But if you listen to Ronan's performance process, for example, you know that there a large part of the reason why the race is faster between the start and... essentially like we'll call it the finale, the whole like sort of last 30K or so, 40K, is because they're significantly more aerodynamic than they used to be, like significantly more aerodynamic than they used to be. We're talking, you know, in the order of sort of 20, 30 watts for that guy in the front. And that just makes the whole group move faster all the time. And that's just sort of the reality of modern cycling. So they come into the Chipressa, you know, about as fatigued as they ever did, right? Even though they went faster. And then they do the Chipressa not as fast as they thought they were going to. Again, there were multiple riders who said that this wasn't very fast, didn't feel very fast. And that's really what's most important. I don't care what the time was. I don't care how they felt.
All I care about is what the time was. I don't care how they feel.
Okay, let's get into this. You have to care what they feel about.
Let me rephrase. I don't care what Tadej Pogacar says he feels like. He is he's our king memer. No, he wants us to think he's invincible.
Live lactic acid values from their legs.
Vanderpool said it wasn't as hard as they expected it to be.
Yeah.
Matthew said it wasn't as hard as they expected it to be. Philipson said it wasn't as hard as they expected it to be. Mohoric. It doesn't actually matter what the time. Mohoric said the same thing. It doesn't actually matter what the time up the climb was. If the riders are all, again, you know, they're all more aerodynamic. They're all better trained. They're all better nutrition. We're not going to get into whatever else might be happening. That's a separate question. But they're all feeling like these two climbs are not as hard as they thought they were going to be, which meant that Pogacar couldn't do what he was going to try to do.
Yes.
If UAE can make the Chipressa as hard as they thought it was going to be, then Pogacar can do what he wanted to do. Which, again, is either solo or a much smaller group than it would have been. And I think it's totally feasible for him to win this race in that way. There you go. There's my 10 minutes of blathering.
Dan, do you want to rebut that since you're the...
Yeah, sure. So I have so many different ways. Let me count the ways in which... So first of all, the reason I don't care what Tadej Pogacar says, how he felt, is that I fully agree. If UAE had been able to make the Chipressa and the Poggio as hard as they wanted to, then... Pogacar can solo clear. I fully agree with that. What I don't agree with is that is possible. They cannot make it harder than it was. The course is not hard enough. Tadej Pogacar is 10 kilos lighter than Mathieu van der Poel, who I believe literally has the best 5-minute power on the planet. And on the Poggio, a 3.7% climb with a section at 8%, sure.
It's not 3 points. That's the thing, is it's not 0.3.7. I've ridden it before. It's not 3.7. A 3.7% climb is like riding up, what is it, like left hand here?
It's
in Boulder,
it's Nelson,
right?
And yeah, like yeah, that too. Got Boulder, yeah, climbs.
It's hardly a climb. There's a bunch of flat sections at every single one of the corners, for example, that drop that percentage down. It kicks up and down, kicks up and down. It feels significantly more than 3.7. I'm just gonna lay that out there.
This is a debate in which facts are important. And the way that you feel about this climb, the fact is it's a 3.7K climb, which
did just give you pretty some numbers about how, like, do we need to get like average non-zero grade? Do we normalize the gradient to add to make this so it's like 7%?
I don't know what it is we need to do to make the facts matter here, but the facts say this is the fastest trip ever up the Poggio, and it's a climb that's not that hard. I think it's physically impossible to make it so hard that Matthew Van Der Poel can't go.
Even on the Chipressa, UAE was not where they needed to be when they needed to be there, right?
They were garbage.
A lot of their energy started because they had to fight through a wall of other riders that were trying to get to the bottom of the climb too in good position before they lost a good kilometer of smacking people around there. In addition to not having, to maybe using some top names too early and not getting the full punch that they wanted on the Chipressa, like, they could 100% execute better. I think with Tudor Pro Cycling, of all people, led into the Poggio this year.
Yeah.
Yeah. And it's like, there's definitely ways.
They do have Matteo Trentin on the team, which I didn't realize they had Matteo Trentin on the team, which is like, okay.
They have a rider who can actually like contend to this race. Okay. Yeah. But all of these things that you're saying, though.
They could do better. They could 100% go faster. Just because this is the fastest time that's ever been does not mean it is the fastest doable. And it's not the most damage doable by a UAE team.
The reason that they were not. So first of all, the group on the Chipressa was, as Rob Hatch said, going into maybe like the second or third kilometer up the Chipressa, like the smallest group on the Chipressa that we've seen in a long time. That was a lined out group. The pace was very high. Yeah. If UAE was unable to set a higher pace, it was because their guys were so tired from doing the hardest Milan San Remo ever. And so everybody else was going to be super
set that
tired.
Pace. It wasn't that their guys were tired. There was a whole kilometer where they were doing a bunch of work that wasn't making the race fast because they were trying to get through this mob. They weren't lining it out and hitting it as hard as they could. Probably 50 people in that group could have ridden at the front harder.
That was true for 30 seconds, maybe? And then it was true for
an entire kilometer.
The 60 only, seconds? The only rider who did what he was supposed to do from UAE on the Chipressa was Isaac Del Toro.
Because they were all tired.
He might have been a little late. He might have gotten there later than I agree with that.
I think Wellens kind of did his job. I don't think he doesn't get an F.
Wellens wasn't supposed to be used till the Poggio.
So right. he doesn't get an F.
The fact that they had to use Wellens in the Chipressa at all.
Hershey, Ulissi, went wrong. Not good. Wellens gets a B. But
Covey, like the team failed. Like they just didn't. My point is it doesn't matter
because they are all too tired from this super hard day. So if
they're not tired from the super hard day, they literally like.
Where was Hershey on the Poggio? Did he just decide not to go? I think he couldn't go.
Yeah. He couldn't go because he didn't do the job he was supposed to be doing.
Yeah, well, he was on the podium at Milano-Torino like 4 days ago. So clearly he's not just some schmo. This is a good team. I don't think the team can get so good as to drop Matthew Van Der Poel. This is the crux of this is you can't drop Matthew Van Der Poel on a climb like this. If Van Der Poel skips the race,
you don't need to. You don't need to drop Matthew Van Der Poel on the Chipressa. You need to take the group on the Chipressa down to basically what they had it down to before it regrouped and keep it there. And then you come into the Poggio with a smaller group. Then you use Wellens and then you use Pogacar. And I guarantee you, Pogacar is nuts. Like he's a freak of nature. So he can get rid of almost everybody, right?
Almost.
Even on a climb that is not actually
suited that
well for him. He wasn't able to do that on Saturday because his team failed to make it hard enough on the Chipressa and the Poggio, as evidenced by every single rider saying,
I agree.
It wasn't that hard.
No, I think that's true.
And so if they do make it hard enough on the Chipressa, which is possible.
No, it's not. But I agree with everything
else. It's a hard enough climb. You can make it hard enough. They didn't. Anytime you have like a sit up and chat 2/3 of the way up the climb, that climb was not hard enough, right? it is physically possible with a better team or a team that is just on better form or a team that just does the thing that they're supposed to do. You could litigate what exactly went wrong with UAE all you want, but the reality is you could do better than they did. If you make the Tresor hard enough, you get to the Poggio with a smaller group. Pogacar can do his thing. He could pull out a couple riders. Maybe it's Vanderpool. Maybe it's Wout van Aert. Maybe it's whoever else. Guess who has frequently lost small group sprints?
I could think of like literally two times in his whole career. You're talking about Vanderpool, right? But like it's been Flanders.
And Vanderpool.
Yeah, okay. It's rare.
Wout van Aert's done the same thing.
It's rare.
I'm saying that at the end of 300K, it comes down to who's the freshest. Who was the most under their threshold for more of the day for the last six and a bit hours, right? And Pogacar, because he is a stronger rider than Vanderpoel and Wout van Aert, he just is.
Like, hard to
disagree,
but that's fine.
He's a stronger rider
than
both those guys.
Yeah.
He's not as good over very short distances, but he is, like, over the course of 6.5 hours, his threshold is higher, right? He comes into that fresher. It's the reason why he's beating Mads Pedersen in a sprint. He can win Milan-San Remo.
All right. So since I nominally, like, my photo is in the podcast, so I at least want to talk for more than 30 seconds. I'm going to try real quick to speed run through my actual points. If I can.
I need to go soon.
If I may. Oh, okay. Great. That's very fitting.
It's a flyby.
I think
a
couple things.
This is, I just come in.
One.
Talk for half an hour, mic drop.
And then leave. Yeah.
What do you think? Yeah.
One.
Okay, give it to me, Dave. Give it to me.
What you're describing, again, I fully agree that UAE wants to make it harder. That's the game plan. I don't disagree with what their game plan is. I can't remember it ever happening. I mean, there's been one time in literally every time I've ever watched this race where a favorite has soloed clear. So I think to break this argument down, I think the chance that Pogacar has is, as you say, to maybe not solo clear. I think maybe he can rely on trying to beat. Yeah, maybe he can rely on trying to beat Vanderpool. That might be a better strategy. Attempting to solo clear has literally, when I have watched this race, never happened by a race favorite except Matthew Vanderpool. He's the only person I've ever seen do it. Every other rider who has soloed clear to win this race, this may sound silly now in hindsight when we say, oh, of course that person won. Nibali had super long odds the year that
he won. All I hear is backpedaling. Cosmo, do you hear the backpedaling?
Whoa,
I can hear
whoa,
the little free wheel tick. Can you hear the free wheel tick?
I was about... Haley, you keep mentioning the Tresa as if it's instrumental to a potential Pogacar win. But like, if Vanderpool is one more rider back, Pogacar goes into that climb alone, or goes into the descent alone. He makes it over the top alone.
Yeah, and then Vanderpool, he gets caught up by Vanderpool in like 5 seconds.
Everybody in that group stares at each other. We don't know.
Nibali, Mohoric, all of these riders are riders that don't have everybody staring at them. This is the problem that Pogacar has. It's that he tells everybody.
Everybody was staring at him, and one person barely caught him. And if that person,
but he
had
did. So what
just
you're
another rider.
What you're describing is the facts. He got caught. He will continue to get caught as long as that guy's there. Or
we've been interrupted by my house host. What's Owen's take?
If Nibali could get clear on the Poggio, Pogacar can.
I agree.
Too.
10 years from now, when nobody's watching Tade anymore because he's old, then he'll get clear. That's his best chance. Yeah,
all I heard was I agree. So
yeah, I agree with that.
I think that.
So come maybe in 10 years. Yeah,
guys, I enjoyed this very much. I do. I love your podcast, and I often listen to it while I'm like skiing or riding or something, and I just shout to myself.
Well, you're welcome to come shout at
so,
us.
And so it was very enjoyable.
This is what I do when I listen to placeholders. So
it was very enjoyable to be able to shout at you.
I do that on placeholders, Kazza, but. Kaylee's the host of that show, and just like he really takes control. And on this show, even though again nominally I'm in the photo, he's also the boss, so it's limited. My ability to control things is limited. You know, Kaylee, thank you for joining us.
I apologize. No, I apologize.
Thank you for joining us.
You know,
and we'll have probably plenty more chances to do this soon because we have plenty more big classics coming up.
You know how like people in bars are like, let's take this outside.
Yeah, let's take this to the podcast.
Let's take this to the podcast.
Yeah.
I enjoyed this very much.
Otter Dome.
Yeah, I'll let you guys. I know there's a bit of Binda to chat coming up.
Yep.
As soon as I leave, Dane can explain why I'm wrong. How about that?
Sounds great. That'll work well. Kaylee, yeah, thanks for joining us. All right, that was Kaylee Fritz dropping his opinion, leaving. I feel like I got about half a response in. I don't know that there's that much more I can say, really. I do think that Pogacar's best chance is either to try to do the sprint or, just lay low for 10 years. Do... I think his best shot is to do the Nibali and not be a favorite. Because Nibali, before this podcast, I went back to look at some of the pre-race previews. He was like a, how we all literally like to do the 5-star, 4-star, etc. He was generally seen as a 1-star favorite going into that San Remo that he attacked.
Like Michele Ferrari.
Say again?
We talked about this earlier. You're agreeing with Ferrari now.
Wait, I thought we said that Michele Ferrari didn't think that was true.
No, he didn't say the race was too easy. He just said everyone was a wimp. But he also said,
okay,
it's really bad to be a favorite at this race.
Well, that is true. All right, I agree with Dr. Ferrari. He is a doctor.
Does he have a license?
Yeah, I was actually,
practice,
now that I say that, does he even still have a medical license? Anyway, I think being a favorite, now that he's not here to cut me off, Kaylee pointed this out at the very beginning of the show. Is that being the guy everybody's watching is the worst thing in this race. And that's what Tadej Pogacar is right now. He needs to lay low. He needs to go do something. He needs to retire and then unretire, come back in a few years. That's going to be his best chance to solo clear. Because otherwise everybody's staring at him and they're gonna chase him down. Climb is not hard enough.
I don't disagree as hard as Kaylee does. I do disagree. I think it would have been really cool to see UAE execute as well as they possibly could have. I think they're going to have some opportunities, assuming the current lineup is more or less intact. Because, they got a lot of guys who are only getting better. Pogacar made a really good effort at it, and it took all of Matthew Van Der Poel to make it come back. And that's saying something. That to me says that it was a lot closer than you might be giving it credit for.
I think that is true about. There was a moment where it seemed like it was the second attack that Pogacar put in, where it seemed like that elastic might snap. But at the end of the day, it didn't. So everyone else is wrong. And Jasper Philipsen, with the help of Matthew Van Der Poel, with a Herculean effort by Matthew Van Der Poel to chase down not only Pogacar, but then as soon as he kind of recovered from that, as we said, all the other times he chased down everybody else to let Philipsen do what he does best. And I think that's what makes them such a good duo. Van Der Poel has his own very good sprint, but Philipsen is faster in a traditional sprint, and that allows them to kind of focus on slightly different things, and that's why they work so well together, as we have now seen, apparently. There's your answer, to your question on Discord there, Strew. And I had another Discord question I wanted to hit up before we finished our convo about San Remo. The question comes from John H. If Ghana didn't have his mechanical, would he have had a chance for the podium? I think it's a hard yes. If you want to say a chance for the podium, absolutely a chance.
Do we know for sure that he had a mechanical, or are we just...
For people who didn't see
the race, there's a couple hairpins down the Poggio descent. Ghana's in third or fourth. Kind of goes into a corner, maybe looks like he's going to make contact with Pedersen. Maybe not. They're on different lines, but... They both kind of come out of it, and Ghana is just in a huge gear. You can see him pedaling, trying to get back up to speed. People are going by him. And I think that's the last time you see him. I don't think he was with the Finnish group in the end, was he?
No, he was not. And he was actually significantly back. He finished more than a minute down. So it seems like a reasonable conclusion, but I haven't, as of recording time, maybe by the time this comes out, we'll know. I don't know. Haven't seen that it was a mechanical or not for certain. But I do think, he's shown that he can sprint pretty well. I think he certainly could have been up there.
I wonder if that alters how Ineos would attempt that finale with Pidcock and Ghana there instead of just Pidcock having to make something up in terrain that does not suit him even slightly, at least once you're off the descent. So
once you're off the descent, everything else about this race seems to suit his skill set pretty well. Yeah. I mean, the descending part really for sure. He would probably like the Poggio to be a little bit harder, as would many. Many people, Slovenians.
No, there's a lot of corners. There's a lot. He was doing a lot of stuff in the group, kind of hopping in and out of the ditch, being very smooth and not kind of altering his lines through corners. I think the current Poggio is pretty favorable for him too, from a handling perspective.
Yeah, that's a good point. All right, so there's that, and then maybe the last point that I had or wanted to talk about here for San Remo is the sort of what does it all mean? The big takeaway for me this past, I don't know, year, involving the riders that really shone at this race, Alpecin De Koenig has got to be the best recent second division team by a mile. I mean, it's not even close. If you look at other teams that were, you know, pro Conti a few years ago, all of them are still just kind of there. You know, we've seen some brave rides from some of the French teams.
These guys have been world tour for or world team top tier for
a few years now. No team that I can remember has gone from being a brand new team with the "we're going to be world tour soon" mentality to being this good. That except them, they're the one. Because a lot of teams, they, you know, we've saw with the Israel team, for instance, relatively new team, decided they wanted to go world tour, put all the money into it, was not good enough to the degree that they actually are no longer world tour. They got relegated, and the situation for Alpecin has been like the opposite. They, even when they were a second division team, were better than many world tour teams, and now they have really taken the peloton, particularly in the races where they're good. It's the one-day races and the sprints. They are right up there with all the other World Tour squads. And I think it's just really impressive to have built this team from being a non-World Tour squad into this powerhouse so quickly. When you look at the Israel's, you know, the, well, there's other teams that were World Tour that are not. Lotto Destiny being one of them.
Did they, when did Intermarché, they pop up?
Yeah, then, you know, they're fine. They're fine. They have gotten themselves upgraded, but they do not win races nearly with the same ability as Alpecin. So just, you know, got to kind of give some credit to the whole organization over there. And the other thing is that it's not just Mathieu Vanderpool. I mean, this is a team that for 2 or 3 years, when you would read headlines on media outlets, they would say Vanderpool's team sometimes instead of Alpecin De Koenig.
To remind you why it was important.
Like, what is that team? Oh yeah, that's Vanderpool's team. And there's so much more than that now. Obviously they just won a monument. Vanderpool was heavily involved, but it was not Vanderpool who took the win. So hats off to Alpecin and Philipsen and his teammate Vanderpool. Hats off to Michael Matthews for a third San Remo podium, even if it was pretty heartbreaking. And as much as I think that his strategy is not going to work, huge credit to Tadej Pogacar for making this race so interesting. And I hope he keeps doing it. I hope he keeps banging his head against the wall. And it'll be great to see me proven wrong, because then I think it'll be entertaining to watch.
Yes. We have to find some sort of pie for you to eat.
Yeah.
At the,
Or
that,
crow.
Should that come to pass?
Crow pie. Yeah.
Yeah. But crow is, seems like it would be yucky.
I would agree with that.
Everybody loves pie.
Yeah. I would think so. All right, let's take one last break. All right, Milan-San Remo weekend means that the day after the men's monument, we got a major women's one-day race. The We'll Talk podcast will break it down in a day from when you are hearing this. But in the meantime, Cosmo, can you give me your headline, what the headline is of the Trofeo Alfredo Binda? Your rapid reaction before we, you know, throw it over to the Wheel Talk crew to really break it down.
Trek pulls and Alpecin. They're very similar vibes. We had the reigning race champion kind of coming in as one of the favorites, doing a lot of marking, a lot of work. Not entirely clear whether or not she was doing teamwork or going for her own chances. Not necessarily that there's a difference between those two. And then in the final reckoning, sprinter who had been very well taken care of came through and took the victory. So,
yeah, Elisa Balsamo, who is pretty fast. We know this. We've seen her be very fast on
fastest in the world
multiple occasions. We've seen her win a rainbow jersey with her speed. But doing what generally has been the province of other teams, well, SD Works with the old 1-2 punch, the ability to kind of control the race. And yeah, it's just really nice job by that whole team. And the other, you know, maybe big talking point, and it's something that Abby Mickey, who is the host of the Wheel Talk podcast, has brought up before, is Lotta Kopecky maybe losing a step in the sprint. Maybe not, but that could be something we're seeing is that her final push maybe is losing a little bit as she increases her abilities in other ways. Something that maybe Wheel Talk will get into. So yeah, make sure you listen to the Wheel Talk podcast tomorrow. They'll have plenty to talk about. All right, other odds and ends. What's coming up this week? More World Tour racing, and actually, World Tour racing in two different places at once, because a lot of the stage racers are going to be over in Spain, over in Catalunya specifically, at the Volta a Catalunya, where one Tadej Pogacar is on the start list. We've discussed him at length so far in this show, and he is staying busy heading over to race a stage race against the likes of, well, Geraint Thomas and Egan Bernal will be there, the former Tour de France winners. Tadej Pogacar's own teammate, Joao Almeida, another ride you got to watch. And then the vaunted Visma Lisa bike squad will be led by American superstar Sepp Kuss, racing on roads that are very familiar to him. He spends a lot of time over there, so be cool to see how he does on a very climber-friendly parkour. So yeah, that's the Volta a Catalunya. Gets underway on Monday. So actually, the race, the first stage will have happened by the time this show goes up. We will see where things go over the course of the week and how Pogacar does in stage race mode. So by the time we are next podding, that'll be coming to an end. So that's one exciting thing to look forward to. The other exciting thing to look forward to is the Flemish Classics getting underway. Brugge de Panne on Wednesday. E3 Harald Becker on, excuse me, I should keep up with the sponsor changes and the official race names. Visma Lisa Bike
Saxo
is,
Classic.
Yeah, the E3 Saxo Classic, excuse me, on Friday. And Gent-Wevelgem on Sunday. So we will almost assuredly talk on the placeholders about E3 and Gent-Wevelgem. Brugge de Panne, I'm not sure. We might record before that. Yeah, I'm not sure exactly where the recording is going to fall. So let's just do a quick look at that start list in case no other pods get to it. The Brugge de Panne start list, that is. It's a race that we may see a very familiar face take a victory, because Jasper Philipsen not only is the defending champion, he's also going back this year. And of course, he seems to be in pretty good form, having just won Milan-San Remo. And a bunch of the other big classics names, well, Vanderpool and Van Aert, are skipping Brugge de Panne. So I would think Jasper Philipsen is your favorite, but I guess we'll find out whether, I don't know, the likes of Tim Merlier and Arno Demar and other fast riders, Fabio Jakobsen, Dylan Groenewegen, it tends to be sprinter-friendly. So yeah, that'll be on Wednesday to kick off this kind of week of big one days. And then, yeah, E3, Gent-Wevelgem on Friday and Sunday, respectively. That's on the men's side. Women's side does not have an E3 event, but it does have Brugge de Panne and it does have Gent-Wevelgem. The women's Brugge de Panne will have quite a few fast-finishing talents, including Lorena Wiebes, Elisa Balsamo, Charlotte Kuhl. And then, yeah, I would imagine we will have other pods to talk about the other races this week. So, yeah, by the next time that you listen to us, we will have three different World Tour one days on the men's side and one stage race on the men's side to talk about, as well as both of those one days on the women's side. It's that time of year. It's very exciting. All right, that's it for us this week. Hope you enjoyed Milan-San Remo and our post-race breakdown. And I hope you got a chance to watch all the great racing coming up. We'll be back soon to tell you how Sepp Kuss flew the American flag, dominated the field at the Volta Catalunya. We're going to sing the national anthem. It's going to be great. Yeah, Tadej Pogacar is there, so I'm not sure that's going to happen. But we will have all of that and more to talk about next week. Thanks for joining us. I'm Dane Cash, and who are you?
Cosmo Catalano.
And what was this?
The How the Race Was Won podcast.